Hello, this is Tamara with the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, June 3rd. Let's begin today's reading on the front page with the article entitled "Fairgoers Off to the Races" about the Macon County Fair. From Donette Beckett in Decatur. Thrilling harness runs, warm-up fairground grandstand. Freddie Patton Jr. and his son Jordan admit they don't get to experience many of the Macon County Fair highlights, such as the carnival and games. "The last time I went to a fair, I was 8 years old," Jordan Patton said, "and it was probably this fair." The father and son instead find fun at the Macon County Fairgrounds racetrack. Mississippi native Freddie Patton Jr., 62, is in the Illinois Harness Racing Hall of Fame and still races. "You get everything in that ride," he said. "You get the adrenaline, you get the thrill, the danger, the adventure, you get it all." Although not as far as his father, Jordan Patton, 28, traveled from Carbondale to compete in the first day of harness races at the Macon County Fair. The father and son racers have competed at the Decatur track in the past. "Decatur's always been special to us," Jordan Patton said. "It's usually the first race. We get to see how our horses are going to do during the summer. The well-established course has its appeal as well," Freddie Patton added. "That's one of the reasons we come here," he said. Just ahead of the traditional festival activities, Downstate Classic Harness Racing brought some excitement to the Macon County Fair on Monday. Entertainment was used to ease the horses. Ladies wore fancy hats with the hopes of winning a prize of their own. "This is the biggest, highest payout standard bred racing in Illinois," said Evan Hall, Macon County Fair president and racing superintendent. "It's a premier race. And it's a nice family-friendly event to have in Decatur. Today at the fair, it's Senior Day. Free admission to those age 65 and up. Gates open from 3 to 10 p.m. Horticulture, floriculture, agricultural products, and culinary items judging at 1 p.m. at the Ag Expo building. Rabbit Show Junior and Open Show judging at 6 at the Rabbit Show Barn. Macon County Fair Queen Pageant and the announcement of the first Macon County Fair King and Queen at the Grandstand. Little Miss Pageant at 6 p.m., Junior Miss and Queen Pageant at 7:15. Cost is $7. Fireworks immediately following Macon County Fair Queen Pageant. After 2 days of harness racing, the grandstand area will be prepared for Wednesday's Queen Pageant, during which a new Little Miss, Junior Miss, and Queen will be crowned. Fireworks will end the night in celebration of the country's birthday. The carnival and food vendors will be ready for the crowds as well. Grandstand lineup for the rest of the week includes a concert by country artist Baker Blankenship on Thursday, rodeo by TNA Bucking Bulls, 7 p.m. Friday, ITPA Truck and Tractor Pulls, 7 p.m. Saturday, and a demolition derby, 6 p.m. Sunday. Tickets can be purchased at MaconCountyFair.com. Jackie Childress, 57, said she has fond memories of the Macon County Fair. "Our backyard came right up on the fairground," she said, "and my dad trained horses at our house." Her family took advantage of all the fair had to offer, such as the tractor pulls, demolition derby, and of course the carnival. "It was like a big family," she said. "They all watched out for us." Continuing the fun, Childress wore a decorated derby hat to the first day of the harness races. "These are my dad's racing colors," she said about the royal blue and yellow flowery hat. "If it doesn't have harness racing, it's not a fair." Again from the front page, from Tony Reed. Local elections. Councilman Horn joins mayoral race. Councilman David Horn believes Decatur is in need of saving, and he is ready to come to the rescue as the city's next mayor. Horn announced Tuesday that he is throwing his hat into the ring as a mayoral candidate in the municipal election set for April 6th. He will face incumbent Mayor Julie Moore Wolf, who announced May 28th that she was running again. Moore Wolf is not only the city's first female mayor, but also its longest serving since she was first appointed to the job in 2015. Horn had challenged her previously in 2019 when Moore Wolf defeated both him and fellow challenger Jacob Jenkins in a three-way race. Now, the 54-year-old Horn, a Millikan University biology professor, first elected to the city council in 2017, says the state of the city's ecosystem compels him to take another shot at Decatur's top political job. "The residents of Decatur are ready for change," he told the Herald and Review. "There have been some long-standing issues that we have not been able to resolve, and it's time for new leadership to work together with fellow council members, other elected leaders, residents, and community organizations to make the changes necessary to improve quality of life for all." Top of Horn's to-do list are declining population and labor force, low wages, crumbling roads, stagnant home prices, and a stubbornly high poverty rate. All of these indicators are of a city that is not working for its residents. And for example, and as we talked about at Monday night's council meeting, our local roads are in the worst condition that they have been in for at least 20 years. Questioned on whether a small city mayor really has the clout to be able to shift the needle on such issues, the challenger remained confident that a Horn mayoralty could make a positive difference. "I firmly believe that with a new mayor, we can begin to address these long-standing issues," he added. "Other cities our size and with our characteristics have turned things around. We can do it. And I think with new leadership, change will take place." Horn moved to Decatur in 2005 and lives in the city's West End with his life partner, Mary Garrison. Now our last article from the front page from Decatur, $4.3 million to fix rough highways approved. Three road segments targeted, another $3 million sought for maintenance. From Tony Reed in Decatur. There is some good news, and quite a bit more bad news coming down the pike for Decatur's road system. First, the good news. The Decatur City Council signed off at its Monday night meeting on a more than $4.2 million project to repair and restore smooth surfaces to 6.2 lane miles on three sections of badly run-down highways this year. A lane mile is a road measurement that takes the number of lanes involved into account. And that follows on from an earlier decision in April to spend $3.1 million to resuscitate about 10 lane miles of potholed and crumbling roadways. But here's the bad news. The city has a total of 850 lane miles of roads, and the overall condition of Decatur's highways, according to Councilman David Horn, is rated 3.98 on the Road Industry Recognized Pavement Surface Evaluation and Rating, or PACER scale. For example, PACER says a road surface scored at a 5 to 6 range needs preservation treatments, but no structural work. But a score of 3 to 4 requires structural renewal and extensive slab or joint rehabilitation. At Monday's meeting, Horn quizzed Matt Newell, the city's public works director, on what it would cost to hold the entire city road system at a PACER score of just 4 for a year. Newell said roughly $3 million ought to do it. And when Horn asked what the additional cost would be to elevate the overall road score by just 0.05, the answer was another $3 million, for a total of $6 million a year, just to hold the city's highways in a state of barely adequate. Horn then told Newell, "The reason I ask these questions is just because our residents complain regularly about the quality of the roads in the city of Decatur. And we're at the lowest road condition index score we have been in 20-plus years. Just to maintain that score, it's $3 million, and just to increase it by 0.05, it's an additional $3 million. So if you think about it from that perspective, just to get back to where we were about 10 years ago, when we were about 4.2, we're going to need $15 million," Horn added. The public works director didn't argue with the numbers, and Mayor Julie Moore Wolf wondered out loud if anyone knows the magic for trying to find that kind of money. Councilman Pat McDaniel said it's hard to keep up with maintenance needs when the city gets hit with that kind of ice and snow it saw last winter, which was probably one of the worst winters we've had with snow and cold, and it really did a number on our streets, McDaniel said. Newell said winters are always hard, and the subsequent freeze-thaw conditions provide fertile broken ground for a harvest of potholes to bloom in the spring. As for the three sections of road due to receive some love in Monday's approved $4.2 million rehabilitation plan, they were identified as North Monroe Street from El Dorado to Sawyer Streets, a distance of just over 4 lane miles. Traffic volume here was assessed by the city's Public Works Department at 9,400 vehicles passing through every 24 hours. Also included was East Cantrell Street from Jasper to 22nd Streets, a distance of 1.5 lane miles, averaging 3,550 vehicles a day. A third chunk of road down for improvement is the half mile of East William Street from 26th Street to Illinois 105, carrying some 2,750 passing vehicles a day. In addition to the paving on these streets, sidewalk curb ramps and curb and gutter at curb ramps will be replaced, said a briefing memo to council from City Manager Melissa Hahn. She noted that new pavement stripping, utility adjustments, and water service replacements will take place as part of the road improvements as well. City staff had put the road repair project up for bid May 20th, and while three contractors took a look at the numbers, only one, Dunn Company, bothered to submit a bid. Their price of $4,256,000 was 1.1% under the estimated bill, and Dunn was awarded the job. Hahn said in her memo that $3.8 million of the cost comes from state motor fuel tax funds. And the final cost also reflects a $315,000 rise over budgeted expenses due to a prolonged spike in fuel fees. It all adds up to the city dipping into additional funds to foot the overall bill. The city's water fund will pay the $587,928,000 cost of water service replacements and other work as part of the project, while sanitary manhole adjustments totaling $41,800 will be covered by sanitary sewer fund. A $60,825 bill for storm manhole, catch basin, and inlet adjustments will be paid for out of the storm water fund. Hahn said siphoning cash from these various sources will mean that other projects will get delayed and will not be completed this fiscal year. Horn wanted to know if the railroad crossing just north of Sawyer Street was included in the North Monroe Street portion of the project. Newell said the road up to and beyond the crossing would be, but not the crossing itself, which remains the responsibility of the railroad to fix. Newell didn't name the railroad, but it appears to be the Canadian National Railway. Horn said the crossing was in the worst shape of any in the city and asked Newell if he had a way to communicate with the railroad responsible and urge them to fix it. If you've got somebody that can communicate well with the railroad, I would appreciate their phone number, Newell said. We struggle with the railroad, and frankly, they almost have to be forced to work on our crossings. You can contact Tony Reed at 217-421-7977 or follow him on Twitter at Tony J. Reed. Continuing now with local news from Tony Reed in Decatur. $606,000 going towards watershed protections. We have a lovely photo of Gracie Luca enjoying a walk with her dogs Buddy and Shayna in this file photo taken Tuesday, April 28th, along Lake Decatur in Nelson Park. EPA grant deal to ward off sediment and pollution in Lake Decatur. The never-ending battle to keep sediment and pollution out of Lake Decatur just got a $606,000 boost. City Council members on Monday passed a resolution authorizing the city to accept a grant agreement with the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency to fund key landscaping works aimed at protecting Decatur's key water source. The cash will pay for constructing 14 land terraces covering some 13,800 feet that act as breaks to slow down and dissipate water flow. Additional work will create a 2,500-foot water and sediment control basin and see the construction of 10.5 acres of grassed waterway. This is designed to control stormwater runoff using vegetation as a physical break and filtering system. The improvements will take place in the countryside, miles away from the lake, but in areas still affecting the vast surrounding watershed that feeds it. And some of the cash will be splashed on updating plans for protecting and improving areas of the Goose Creek watershed, located mainly in Piatt County and the Findlay Creek watershed that originates in Mount Zion, which both drain into the lake. Work on the package of improvements is due to begin in September and is designed to implement best management practices, or BMPs, according to Decatur City Manager Melissa Hahn. The constructed BMPs will reduce annual pollutant loading to Lake Decatur of approximately 506 tons of sediment, 556 pounds of phosphorus, and 3,639 pounds of nitrogen, Hahn told the council in a memo. Although these amounts represent a small percentage of the estimated sediment nutrient loading on Lake Decatur, The cumulative effect over time is significant, especially when combined with other watershed projects. Out of that $606,000 total project cost, an IEPA grant will pour in $363,633 in federal funds, with city taxpayers contributing the remaining $242,400. But it isn't all plain sailing, however. Hahn warned the council that original cost estimates for the project date back to 24, and the rising red waters of inflation are expected to have swelled the final bill. Due to significant cost increases since then, it is conservatively estimated that the city may have to expand additional cost share funds from its Water Lake capital budget, Hahn added. However, the adopted budget is expected to be sufficient to cover this difference. Monday's city council meetings also found council members in a special spending mood for other areas of Lake Decatur outlay. They signed off on a $97,930 repair bill to have Villa Grove-based firm Paul's Machine and Welding carry out major repairs to the South Gate hoist mechanism, controlling one of the giant gates releasing excess water at the Lake Decatur Dam. Hahn said the hoist machinery that moves both the north and south gates had been damaged when an attempt was made to open them to let out water during bitterly cold conditions in January of 24. Various firms had been approached to do repairs, but Paul's Machine was the only one interested in doing the work, Hahn told the council in a memo. The firm had since carried out a complete design and rebuild of the drive frame for north slew gate and hoist machinery, and having done such a good job, Hahn said the Public Works Department wants them back to handle the south gate hoist mechanism repairs. Council members unanimously agreed to hire the firm again with a total contract price of $107,930, which reflects an additional $10,000 thrown in to allow for unforeseen contingencies that may arise. Now from state news in Springfield, Jack O'Connor from Chicago Tribune. Education, Illinois. State bans cell phones in schools. After falling short last year, Illinois lawmakers gave final approval Sunday to a measure that would prohibit students from using cell phones throughout the day at most public and charter schools. The measure, approved in the State House in April, next heads to the desk of Governor J.B. Pritzker, who made the issue a top priority during the past two spring legislative sessions. The State Senate last year approved a less restrictive version without opposition, but it was never taken up in the House. Every parent and educator knows the damage that unchecked screen time and social media can do to our children, and how disruptive they can be in school, Pritzker said in a statement Sunday, shortly after the Senate vote. The bipartisan support for this effort reflects the urgency educators and families across Illinois feel. Beginning in the 27-28 school year, every public and charter school district without an existing phone policy will be required to institute a bell-to-bell ban for elementary and middle school students. High school students may use phones during lunch or breaks at each district's discretion. Districts may also permit phone use during emergencies or for educational purposes. Last year's version, which only required phones to be banned during class time, was met with some opposition in the House vote from lawmakers who raised concerns about the potential for unfair and uneven enforcement, said Democratic Representative Michelle Mussman of Schaumburg, the main House sponsor. Teachers are frustrated that they're having to police students over their phones. Students are distracted by their phones. All of the research I've seen shows this is going to help them focus, cut down on bullying, and lead to a better school environment, Mussman said. But many of those concerns were addressed through a series of amendments. The version awaiting Pritzker's signature prohibits fines, fees, the involvement of local police or school resource officers, and suspensions or expulsions as enforcement tools. It includes mandatory exceptions for students with medical needs, individualized education programs, or primary caregiving responsibilities for a family member. If a phone breaks, schools and teachers are not liable as long as the device was stored in good faith and in accordance with district policies. The legislation's passage comes amid a national reckoning over phone use in schools, as administrators and parents increasingly argue that phones are a major distraction from learning. Jessica Handy, executive director of the education advocacy group Stand for Children, said phones prevent students from being fully engaged in the classroom and lead to a less lively school environment. It is a huge distraction when kids have their phones with them, Handy said. Even if they are not actively using their phone, but their phone is making noise and beeping, and they can tell that it's there, it has a big impact on their ability to learn. Many Illinois school districts have already implemented their own phone bans. At the start of the school year, Hinsdale High School District 86 and Hinsdale-Clarendon Hills Elementary District 181 began requiring students store their devices in a cell phone holder or another designated location during class. Glenbrook High School District 225 banned phones during class in 24, while the Champaign Unit 4 School District implemented the stricter bell-to-bell ban that same year. Districts like Hinsdale and Glenbrook, with existing policies that differ from the statewide ban, would be allowed to keep them until the 2030-31 school year. Research on the effectiveness of phone bans varies. A study by the RAND Corporation found that an urban Florida school district saw test scores and attendance improve within 2 years of implementing a ban. But an April report from the National Bureau of Economic Research found that phone bans had little to no effect on academic achievement, perceived bullying, or attendance. A 2026 study in the Journal of the American Medical Association reported that even in schools with restrictions, students still spend more than an hour on their phones during the school day on average. The proposed Illinois ban mandates districts adopt phone storage guidelines, but doesn't outline that those guidelines should look like. Safely storing every student's phone during the school day can come at a high cost. Several districts in Illinois that have already banned phones have opted for Yonder pouches, a popular magnetic locking phone storage device, which can cost between $20 to $25 per student, depending on school size and order volume, Yonder spokesman Liz Baker said in a February email. Elgin-based school district U46 spent more than $170,000 last year on 6,625 pouches and the accompanying 120 magnetic bases needed to lock and unlock them. Those same pouches cost the Danville District $70,000 in 2025 and Peoria Public Schools nearly $250,000 the year before. Mussman said in February that free or lower-cost alternatives are available, including storing phones in schools' existing lockers. Upon Pritzker's signature, Illinois will have joined more than 30 other states that ban or limit the use of phones during school. Now part one from our opinion page. Our topic is Fueling Summer. Our first column from James Rosen, a former political reporter and Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. He wrote this for Inside Sources. Travelers deserve a holiday from the federal gas tax. I'm not a knee-jerk anti-tax fellow. While no one enjoys paying taxes, I recognize that federal, state, and local levies fund a broad range of critical needs, including schools, parks, libraries, police, public health, and scientific research. One specific levy, the federal gas tax, funds highway and bridge construction as well as public transit. It has projected revenues of $37 billion this year. As a native of Detroit who learned to drive on the nation's first highway, I'm a big fan of our amazing interstate system and the U.S. routes that feed into it. I'm an even bigger fan of the road and bridge maintenance that helps make driving safe for the country's 280 million motor vehicles. The federal gas tax pays for that, too. So I normally wouldn't advocate for suspending such a vital levy, which has been 18.4 cents per gallon since 93. I'm also loath to support President Donald Trump's misguided war in Iran. But suspending the federal fuel tax would ease gas prices that have increased by an average of $1.52 per gallon nationwide since the war started. This is largely because Iran blocked the Strait of Hormuz, through which one-fifth of the world's crude oil supply passes. Americans need some relief, now. Trump asked Congress for a gas tax holiday. A motley mix of Democrats and Republicans is backing his call for a gas tax suspension. Republican Senators Josh Hawley of Missouri and Rick Scott of Florida, along with Democratic Senators Mark Kelly of Arizona and Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, are among the lawmakers voicing support. Democrat Alex Vindman, running for the Senate in Florida, is on board. I'm hearing from Democrats, independents, and Republicans alike about her surging gas prices are putting the squeeze on families' budgets, Vindman said in a May 12th statement. While still a bit lower than the national average, the average gas price in Florida has surged from $2.88 to $4.34 a gallon since the start of the Iran war. With the national average hitting $4.53 per gallon as of May 20th, suspending the gas tax would provide only mild relief, about 4%. State gas taxes are higher in every state except Alaska, and in some states much higher, from California's levy of 70.92 cents per gallon to 58.7 cents in Pennsylvania and 54.50 cents in Indiana. California drivers pay $6.16 per gallon on average, the highest price in the country. It's a small percentage, but it's still money, Trump said May 11th. Congress first imposed the federal gas tax in 1932 as the Great Depression drained federal coffers. It started at 1 cent per gallon. Had it merely kept up with inflation since then, the tax would be about 24 cents today. And inflation since 1993, when Congress last raised it, would put it at about 42 cents. So, if anything, the gas tax is overdue for an increase. But not now. Americans need some relief this summer. As mild as it might be, suspending the gas tax would be welcome at the start of vacation season, when Americans take to the roads in large numbers. With growing bipartisan support, Congress should pass a 6-month suspension of the federal gas tax to prevent a big hit to the Highway Trust Fund, which relies on revenue from the tax. Lawmakers should adopt a plan by Kelly and Blumenthal to offset the loss of highway funds with temporary transfers of general purpose funds from discretionary programs. If Congress wants to get creative, it could pair indexing the gas tax to inflation to meet future road needs with automatic short-term suspensions in the event of price spikes caused by war, economic shocks, or other special circumstances. We'll read our second column on this topic in the second half of the reading of the newspaper. From Springfield, Brendan Moore and Ben Zielinski. We didn't have time. Pritzker and leaders defend adjourning session without a Bears deal. From Springfield. Hours after Illinois lawmakers failed to approve a stadium incentive structure aimed at keeping the Chicago Bears in Illinois, Governor J.B. Pritzker acknowledged that Pride and Joy of Illinois may make a deal to build a football palace in Indiana. That said, Pritzker and the leaders of the House and Senate defended their processes and priorities at a news conference Monday morning, about 5 hours after they adjourned an all-night session. They told reporters that a combination of the late emergence of bill language in the Senate, along with their own red lines to not hand out taxpayer dollars to a football team valued at nearly $9 billion, kept it out of the end zone. That might happen, Pritzker said of the team taking a stadium deal to build across the state line, where Hoosier lawmakers have pledged $1 billion in public subsidies. But the reality is, I wasn't willing to give up billions of dollars of taxpayer money in order to give it to a billionaire-owned family or team, as much as emotional connection as many of us have to the Bears and to keeping them in the city of Chicago or the state of Illinois, he added. At the same time, Pritzker said he would work with House lawmakers over the summer on a stadium package, and his hope is that we'll be able to provide something for the Bears. Pritzker said a special session this summer would be up to the legislative leaders, though House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch, Democrat Hillside, told Capital News Illinois early Monday morning that he wasn't considering it. We've excerpted this story for the full in-print version, see page A8 in the Wednesday, June 3rd edition. From our food page, we have Feast in 15, a quick skillet recipe great for easy weeknight dinners. This versatile dish features juicy shrimp, tossed with blistered tomatoes, fresh herbs, and a rich green sauce that comes together in about 15 minutes using just one pan. Serve it alongside a hunk of crusty bread or over pasta or rice. It's even tasty as a topping for pizza. Look for shrimp that are free from preservatives, which can alter the texture and add sodium to the dish. The brightness and fresh flavor of refrigerated pesto is great here, but a homemade version would be delicious too. This is from Eating Well magazine and website devoted to healthy eating as a way of life. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour. Please stay tuned.